powerful. With powerful objects and material environments within which forms of Buddhist practice take place. As Paula mentioned this morning, unfortunately, Julia Shaw, who contributed an essay on Buddhism and the natural environment, with natural in quotation marks, will not be able to join us today. The names of our session contributors are followed by their essay titles and affiliations. Susan Huntington, Ohio State University Emeritus, who contributed the essay on the agency of images, and Miranda Shaw, University of Richmond Emeritus, who wrote an essay on dance as Vajrayana practice. So, Susan, welcome. Please get us started.
Thank you so much. First, I do want to offer thanks to both Paula and Kevin for not only producing this groundbreaking volume, but for allowing the authors to have today's discussion. A number of things that were said this morning are very relevant to the panel that Miranda and I have put together, and I hope that the two of us can add to the conversation. Because Julia Shaw was unable to participate, Miranda and I have divided our session into two 12-minute portions. I will speak first, followed by some questions from Miranda, and then she will speak, followed by some questions from me. In preparation for this panel, we identified several themes that we wanted to address, some of which have already been mentioned this morning. Specifically, these are finding the edge where our work can be a foundation for the future, exploring ways to move ahead, such as through interdisciplinary thinking, and identifying obstacles that might hinder these effects, such as terminology, as well as disciplinary resistance to the approaches other than those that are textual. So in my essay, I talked about the fact that the words in Buddhism's written texts and oral transmissions communicate the extensive body of Buddhist teachings from ancient times to the present. My essay proposed that the figural images that are featured in Buddhist settings throughout the world are also texts, although nonverbal, and must be understood as an essential element in Buddhist practice. Virtually ubiquitous in Buddhism, figurative images abound in Buddhist monasteries throughout the Buddhist world and among most, if not all, lineages. Such images are the focus of what has been called ritual, but which, in light of Paula's comment this morning, perhaps are better called meaning-making activities. In particular, this new way to describe these activities helps us move away from very Western concepts, such as image worship and the idea of the icon. Traditionally, Buddhist images have been discussed, excuse me, under the rubric of art, a term I find problematic both because it carries with it unwanted connotations from today's modern use of the term, and more importantly, because it does not capture the true function of these works. For one thing, art historical investigations typically emphasize the creation of such works, that is, their birth, who made them, when, and how, rather than their life after creation. But by exploring how Buddhists use these images, we see how they are an essential feature of Buddhist practice. Simply, these images are bathed, fed, adorned, and venerated as living beings on a daily basis because they are endowed with the agency to answer prayers and perform miracles. Building on the recent studies of miraculous images and consecration practices, my essay describes some of the ways that devotees venerate images, the agency attributed to images, and the methods by which images are invested in their powers. Finally, my essay explores the history of image veneration, asking whether these practices were core features of Buddhism from its early days or later additions to the spectrum of reverent activities. In contrast to the past century of scholarship, which has held that the Buddha image was not only a purely artistic invention, but one added to Buddhism many centuries after the lifetime of the Buddha, I argue that the Buddha image was a core feature of Buddhist practice from the beginning. Although we lack the earliest examples, which were likely made of ephemeral materials such as sandalwood, the absence of evidence should not be seen as evidence of absence. As head of the monastic community, even after his nirvana, Shakyamuni lives on in his images, perpetuating his teachings, overseeing the activities of the Sangha, and offering assistance to his followers. At most, if not all Buddhist monasteries, a specific hall is created to house the Shakyamuni image, where assemblies and ceremonies are performed in his presence. Veneration of other Buddhist beings in the form of their image is also central to the teaching of a variety of traditions. And like Shakyamuni's, these images are enlivened and endowed with agency. Such images can be reifications of concepts so abstract that the forms they take in the material world can provide a first step towards grasping their significance. Acts of devotion, such as taking darshan and providing the images with offerings, are concrete ways that devotees gain understanding and merit and cultivate the virtues and mindset necessary for attainment. As with all Buddhist practices, however, these acts must transcend the outer choreography and arise from the correct inner intention. Only then can these practices be expected to yield a desired response from the image. So, Miranda, ask some questions.
All right, I'm not allowed to turn on my camera, but I'll have to be, So I'll never see Buddhist images again after reading your chapter. You've drawn attention to the way that, or a few cases. There's a huge amount of interference in photo from competing with my voice. So you've drawn attention to cases in which images were central to the transmission of Buddhism. Could you say more about that?
Okay. I think a common paradigm is that the text went first. And we think of people like Xuanzang and others who might have come from China or other places who came to India for the teachings. But in the documents that we have, we find that the image often went hand in hand with Buddhism when it was transplanted to a new area. For example, in China, the indigenous term for what we call Buddhism was in fact the religion of images. We know that the Jokong image, the Jowo Shakyamuni in Tibet, was foundational to the practice of Buddhism in Tibet. The Mahamuni image in Thailand was supposedly not only created but enlivened by Shakyamuni himself when he went to Thailand to introduce his teachings. And there are other examples throughout the Buddhist world of the images, or for example, the famous one when the king of Pekche, that is Korea, gave the Amitabha triad to the king of Japan. So we find that the foundational practice, this foundational transmission of Buddhism was often through the form of the gift of an image or the foundation of an image.
All right, there's long been a bifurcation between art history and Buddhist studies. I think the sound is better now.
Yes.
So could a change in terminology, for example, replacing the term art, help us better understand the role of images in Buddhism?
That's a really good question. And one of the things I have struggled with is trying to find alternative terms by which we can refer to the images. Now, the images that I'm talking about are not including things like paintings on the walls or sculpted reliefs and so on. I'm really talking about the images that are the focal point of veneration. When you go to a Buddhist temple, they will be on the altars and so on. you know, there may be terms within other languages that I don't know about. But for example, in India, I have tried to apply terms like pratima or murti, vigraha, some of these kinds of terms that refer to images. And we do use Sanskritic terms to describe many things within Buddhism. And we talk about dharma, we talk about karma and moksha, you know, these kinds of things. We feel comfortable doing that. And so I'm wondering whether we could use such terminology. I mean, one problem with the term art is that today art is often seen as an aside from what are the real things that we do in society. Art is something extra that is taught in school if all the basics have been covered. Of course, who knows what the basics are today with the current conversations going on in our country. But it trivializes the importance of it. And I think to those who don't study art, it prevents us from giving what I would call the rightful place in Buddhist studies of the study of images.
Thank you. So we have 12 minutes left. Should I?
Sure. You want to go ahead with your paper? Start. Yeah.
Okay, I can give you another question.
Sure. Okay.
Okay, for a brief answer. So the reigning theory in art history for at least a century, and even in the current exhibit of early Buddhist art at the Met, that is that Buddhists didn't create Buddha images, right, and even prohibited images of the Buddha, and only got the idea from Western influence from contact with the Greco-Roman world. And can you address that reasoning?
Yes, I can. The question is whether I can do it in a minute or two, because as you know, this has been something that I've been working on for many years and have published very extensively on. In my view, Buddhism is not an image-avoiding religion. It is, images are central to the practice of the religion. So the question is, if it wasn't from the beginning, when did this revolution occur? And of course, the art historical traditional explanation is, well, when we start to find all these images made out of stone, I believe that they existed much earlier, were likely made of ephemeral materials. But if there was such a major revolution, and I mean, it would be major if for 500 years it had been prohibited, we would certainly find evidence of disagreement, discussion, should we adopt the image, should we not? And we would see a bifurcation into the image making and non-image using traditions. And we just don't see that. And therefore, I believe that if we look at what is the purpose of the image, it's not just to create something for a museum wall, but to use as part of the daily practices of Buddhists, it seems to me that it's foundational.
And so another vehicle of the presence of the Buddha that's been so important, right? The real presence in so many. Thank you. All right. Now I'll present my work on Buddhist dance on this. My work on the Vajrayana dance of Nepal, Charyanurtya, touches on a range of fields of inquiry, dance ethnography, cross-cultural dance studies, South Asian dance and yogic traditions, and a smattering of studies of Buddhist dance. None of these has proven directly applicable to my work or provided a template for my analyses. Scholars of Buddhist philosophy join a sophisticated conversation in progress that is rooted in the terminology and structuring of the philosophical texts. Similarly, Buddhist scholars benefit from granular textual treatments of varied contemplative, analytic, and inner yogic practices. Tantric texts are a tricky terrain. Vajrayana elevates the body as a locus of practice and realization, but does not offer detailed descriptions of bodily practices or explanations of how a given practice accomplishes its goals. The dance practice can be undertaken to pursue the full gamut of Buddhist goals, from meditative stability and the six perfections through emptiness, transcendent bliss, and Buddhahood itself. My challenge is to explain how these lofty attainments come within the domain of bodily practice and somatic experience, and thus to establish how Vajrayana dance serves as a spiritual discipline by drawing connections between specific movement sequences and the qualities and realizations that are sought. For this, I've had to develop my own vocabulary and analytic frames. Dance widens the lens for interpreting other elements of Vajrayana in Nepal, such as the ritual life, architecture, and material culture. More broadly, the presence of the dance practice sheds new light on Vajrayana imagery and aesthetics. The dance expanded my understanding of the iconographic features of various deities. For example, by seeing a mudra or posture not as a static pose, frozen in time, symbolic in intent, but as part of a movement that has an integral relationship to the quality it expresses. This shift in perspective reveals that in the Newar Buddhist imaginaire, the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and wrathful protectors embody qualities of movement and energy and are present in the weave of experienced reality as dynamic beings. For practitioners, the deities model ways of moving through the world that liberate oneself and others from suffering and illusion, ways that can be cultivated through dance. Any questions?
Oh, okay, wonderful. Good. Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on this paper, because most people who study Buddhism wouldn't have dance as one of the top issues. I'll start my video. Hang on. Oh, let's see. I'm not in control of my video. So somehow it was taken off.
Someone will put you
there. It has to be.
I can hear you.
Yeah, I know. But I've just gotten a message here. Start my video. Okay, let's just see. Hang on. Okay, great. Okay, great. Good. I think that if people would, say what are the top 100 things we should study when we study Buddhism, probably dance would not be one of them. And yet I think your paper really makes the case of how important this is, both for the practitioner and for those who are witnessing it. Could you say a little bit more about how dance moves the practice of Buddhism further ahead through, it could be through gestures, through intentionality? How does dance move the goals of Buddhism closer?
Move the practitioner forward on the path. All right, so the bodily movement itself is the locus of transformation, but the understanding of the body is multi-layered. And so you have the fleshly corporeal body, then you have emotional and mental layers, and then these subtle energetic layers, the inner yogic anatomy. And so intervention at any one of these levels affects the others because they're a continuum. And so the dance points that intervention in bodily movement. And so, for example, to develop the virtue, the bodhisattva virtue of patience, for example, one of the dance movements is to glide on the balls of one's feet just exquisitely slowly. And so actually slow movement, steady, flowing, slow movement requires a great deal of patience. I mean, it requires a great deal of mindfulness, of presence. You can't be distracted. You can't hesitate, right? Or you'll get a jagged movement or you'll falter in some way. And so as you're doing this very slow movement, the quality of patience is being learned. It becomes part of your kinesthetic repertoire. And you travel that path over and over, so that when a situation arises that would cause you to become impatient, you have that repertoire of movement and the somatic contours of patience within you. And so you can fall back on that. And then if there's something in the way of your patience, such as, for example, you have like a sense of urgency or a sense of resistance to what's happening, right? Irritability, even anger. And so you feel that arise in your body, but you remember how to return to that steady state, that somatic steady state of patience. And so you don't have an excuse anymore, like to just give into it when you feel the impulse, but it is a bodily conversation. And so it makes you aware of things that can arise, can be like mental blockages and emotional blockages that you're not consciously aware of, but that arise in your internal dialogue. And then also karma from previous lives. You're encountering the karmic knots. You're clearing those as you do that. And so each movement, then I relate to each movement sequence, I relate to the goals that it accomplishes.
In terms of dance, you also discuss it as a ritual. Now, the word ritual was discussed this morning as to whether that is the appropriate term and so on. But could you comment on dance as part of ritual or whatever term you might want to use?
Well, absolutely. So the your essay discusses how human created images serve as vessels for living embodiments of the Buddha and other, you know, Buddhist beings. So this is an exact parallel to the dance, because the dancer becomes a living vessel of the presence of the deity in a ritual setting. And the presence of the deity is required for those esoteric rituals, right? It assures the efficacy of the ritual. And then the human practicing the dance then can similarly gives darshan to those who are witnessing the dance. So they're actually feeling what everyone feels, the awe, the inspiration, the blessing, right? The adhishtana of seeing the deity moving in their midst.
Wonderful. I don't know if we have time for another question, but if so, I mean, could you comment on how dance and why dance has been sidelined in the study of Buddhism?
So I feel that, you know, Buddhist studies are a subfield of religious studies, and dance has been omitted and indeed deliberately excluded from religious studies. And for well-documented reasons, and, you know, universities have their roots, you know, modern universities in monasteries in Europe, and then they became seminaries in the United States and evolved into colleges. And so there's this strain of kind of the anti-dance stance has been traced to kind of this vehemently anti-dance strain of Protestant theology. And is also, I think, deeply embedded in our Western kind of Platonic mind-body dualism. And so I really feel that insofar as the study of religion was constellated as a logocentric enterprise, I think Buddhist studies has followed suit.
If we have time for still one more question, I would like to ask you the question about vocabulary. I mean, I've already taken issue with art. Paula took issue with ritual. Are you okay with the word dance, or how can
The word dance is fine, even though I think in the West it connotes a kind of secular or entertainment artistic genre, and in the Dewey Decimal System, it's in games and toy in athletics, right? But dancer, I have a problem with, because when I'm talking about the one who dances and I say dancer, that connotes this kind of Western idea of someone who has dance as their profession or artistic pursuit. And so I try to sprinkle that with dance practitioner, meditating dancer, you know, different things. And then also when I say perform a movement, I mean, that's what we say when you perform a movement, but you know, the word performance gets in there. You're practicing a movement, but you're performing a movement, not for an audience. So that's a problem. And then I would say the perennial issue of the terms body and mind, right? Because what their understanding is like this continuum. But I think all Buddhists, many Buddhist scholars come up on this perennial issue. So I just surrender and use body and mind.
Okay. Good. Well, I think, I don't know if we've used up our time, but I think we can conclude.
Yeah, we have.
Or do we have? Yeah. Okay, good.
At least according to the schedule, it goes to 2:40. So,
okay, perfect.
2:40 is now 2:41. I mean, 4:40.
Yeah.
1:40, whatever. We're a minute over.
Okay, good. So I don't know if Kevin is taking over or Paula.
Well, I'm taking over to thank you for your presentations, and I appreciate the rich dialogue that you structured into your presentations. I think it's been extremely illuminating. So with that, let me thank you and hand things over to Paula for our next session.
So you can let Mahinda in. Took Mahinda out. And Mahinda. Good afternoon. We're going to continue with another session that is combining two sections of the book, Body-Mind Transformations and Human and Non-Human Interactions, being put together. So this panel is about the dominance of text-based analysis in Euro-American Buddhist scholarship and how it has privileged mind over body. So we're building on the last discussion, elevating meditative practices and devaluing embodied rituals, especially those done for disworldly benefits. The theme of body-mind transformation illuminates diverse Buddhist practices and the related dynamics of embodied sense experience. Early 19th century Euro-American academia cast Buddhism as atheistic. Accounts represented as a rationalistic philosophy, in contrast to Hindu theism and its devotional orientation. Both anthology sections, Body-Mind Transformations and Human and Non-Human Interactions, open views of a Buddhism filled with rich sonorities, common human needs, and vivid images of heavenly realms replete with protective deities. And we will start with Mahinda, who's pretending to be in the Bay Area, but he is at Mahinda Degala. He's actually at Bath Spa University, and his chapter, Oral Practices of Chanting and Protection. And then Charles Joan, who has flown in from across the continent from Catholic University of America in DC. He will talk on his work was Pure Land Practice. And then now I am Stephen Jenkins, and he taught at Humboldt State University, emeritus now, and his chapter was on Heavenly Rebirth and Buddhist Soteriology. So Mahinda, you can start us off for the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you very much for Kevin and Paula for inviting for this symposium. And I have been privileged allowing me to be part of the book project, which actually contributed for my scholarship. So my research, primarily on Sri Lankan Buddhism. And I thought that I will take, chapter was on oral practices. And I thought that I will discuss a little bit a part of that chapter in relation to the discussion we had. Now, we had earlier discussion here about the ritual, to what extent, how we can, whether the practice should be taken second place and rituals should be given the first place in the volume. And as I see it, I think in the volume, the ritual is everywhere. For example, in my chapter about oral practices, and I talk about you know, the recitations and chanting and preaching and all sorts of things. But then I focus on a very contemporary example of a pilgrimage to Sripada, you know, one of the mountains in Sri Lanka, sacred mountains. And in English, it's called Adam's Peak. And now in that place for 6 months, from full moon of December to full moon of May, thousands of pilgrims, you know, climb up in the night. And there, I think, the reason I wanted to use it, that in religious studies, and in particular in study of Buddhism, we have underemphasized or de-emphasized the importance of body or embodiment. It's in particular, sports, exercise, and also asceticism. And now here, this is a good example that one way of honoring the Buddha is taking this difficult journey and traveling up, climbing up the mountain and paying respect all the way to the top of the mountain and coming back. And there are rituals all the way through from the beginning to the end. There are stations, for example, people do the needlework, and there are stations where you will take the pipe precepts and you leave your, you have a sacred bathing like in the Ganges in the river and things like that. Now here is fascinating to me because it brings wide variety of people. Of course, young people come there as entertainment. So the kind of there also breaks the dimension between secular and the religious, because ritual we understand more as a religious thing, even though there could be secular rituals. But here, even though elderly people climb there for primarily for devotion, a sign of devotion, and also in some ways seeing the Buddha. And then also there is a beautiful aspect. Once you climb up to the mountain, early in the morning, you can see the sun rising far away. And people will view that as actually even the nature, the sun, paying homage to the Buddha, because you know Buddhists know that the Buddha attained enlightenment early in the morning. The sun appearing through the sky and the clouds covering it, etc., seen as that sun appears three times and pay respect to the Buddha. So the people think these things, make arduous journey, difficult journey, and perhaps in the earlier it was a very risky business because there are wild animals in the area and so on, and then relationship the nature and so on there. So they are chanting, the poems are chanted, the Pali verses are chanted, and that was, I wanted to bring it. Of course, like we have to think about the Kaihogyo practice, the Hiesan in Japan, for example, one of the interesting ways of using your body to realize enlightenment. Of course, it doesn't happen in the same way in Sri Lanka, but at least Sripada gives a kind of very interesting, rich recitation practices combined with nature and environment. Thank you very much.
Start now?
Yes. Am I lost?
Yes. but you can turn your camera off if you want, I guess.
Am I lost?
There you are. So we'll turn the owl camera on too. Okay.
Thank you. Were you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I was not sure. Thank you.
Okay. All right, well, it's very good to see my old friend Mahinda Degali again. I haven't seen you since we traveled around China together. And I want to add my thanks to Paul and Kevin for the Herculean task that they performed here. I co-edited the volume once, and when I was done with that experience, I said, if I ever say I'm going to do that again, kick me hard. I've seen some of how that particular sausage is made, and it's not easy. So you've earned inestimable merit. Okay. In approaching my remarks for today, I shied away from talking about what I'd actually written in my chapter, because it was a long time ago, and I've frankly forgotten what I said there. But I read Mahinda's and Professor Jenkins's chapter and sort of saw many insights in there relating to my own work and related to this overall theme of embodiment, building on what Mahinda just said about the pilgrimage and the use of chanting. I found that very fascinating to read how the chanting was more than just an expression of devotion, if I understand him correctly. It was a way of pacing yourself as you climb the mountain to where the Buddha's footprint is. The chanting reminds me sort of the use of sea shanties to coordinate a bunch of people trying to do a common effort today together by regulating their breathing and getting them to work together to a certain rhythm. And how the chanting was also a way of educating novices who were making their first pilgrimage in how they should be approaching this, what they should be feeling in their body, what they should be thinking, how what emotions they should be feeling. And when you talk about embodiment, I worry that without us even being conscious of it, our Western notions of individualism and the enclosed self come in. So by individualism, I think we tend to think that embodiment in religious practice means it's all about me and what am I feeling and what's going on with me. And when I talk about the enclosed self, I'm drawing on Charles Taylor's, he has a whole history of what it means to be a self throughout Western history. And he said the enclosed self, the idea that we're sort of locked in our own heads, and what we're thinking and feeling is not really available to anybody else unless we choose to express it. That's playing into when we're talking about embodiment. So what Mahinda Dagali's chapter made me think of is corporate embodiment, a whole group of people who are feeling something together and are using their movements together, their journeys to the same place, as what the Greeks used to call phronesis, you know, a training in how to be, not just techne, which had to do with how do you actually do a specific task, or praxis, which would be reflections on an activity general, as when we talk about the practice of medicine. But phronesis would be educating the character, forming the character. And so when we get locked in our ideas of embodiment seen through the lens of Western individualism and the enclosed self, we may be missing the phronesis of group activities, where by doing something bodily together, you're being educated not on how your body does feel, but how it should feel. Not on just what emotions you are feeling, but what emotions you should be feeling. I pointed this out with some of my students at Catholic University and said, when you're faced with a symbol like a crucifix, when you went to Catholic school, you were taught how to feel in the presence of that thing. In other words, if you broke out laughing, you were clearly in need of some education as to how to manage your emotions in the face of this corporate religious experience that you were all having. So I want us to think more about getting past Western individualism and really thinking about the embodiment of ritual as being an education in how to be embodied, where you are being formed by the group that you're with. Now, when I read Professor Jenkins' chapter, this was one of those experiences where somebody takes what's been in front of your face your whole academic career and tells you what it really means. I really appreciated it for that. I mean, I have been reading Buddhist scriptures for several decades now, and I know the gods are there, and I know that they're in the audience listening to the Buddha preach, and I know that some of them are Buddhists and some of them are arhats, and yet I still had this idea that somehow rebirth in one of the heavenly realms was a really bad thing because you tend to get really caught up in the sensuality of the heavens and it's a real impediment. Now, I would add to what Professor Jenkins said that this debate is still going on. In my studies of Chinese Pure Land Buddhism, I have been very aware of polemics between those who want to be reborn in the Pure Land of Amitabha Buddha and those who want to be with Maitreya in the Tushita Heaven. And one of the critiques made of the Tushita Heaven is it's too sensual. And remember, the gods are horny. Those gods are running like rabbits up there. And it is so easy to get distracted by the ravishing goddesses. And of course, this is a totally male discourse. Nobody talks about women being distracted by the well-built gods, that you will be knocked off course. And so you should really go to the Pure Land where, depending on how philosophical you want to be, there's either no women there, nothing but men, which makes it great, or there's just an absence of any kind of gender distinction at all. The difference was split by cordoning off a portion of the Tushita Heaven. They called it Maitreya's inner court. And as long as you can get there, you'll get past all the goddesses who might knock you off course. So there's still a debate about how embodiment and the desirability of a heavenly rebirth might play together. Beyond that, I've been really struck. I mean, I really feel what Todd Lewis said. I'm old enough to remember when there was a Buddhist studies newsletter that was edited by Richard Garg, which was simply a catalog of who was translating what scripture. And that's what Buddhist studies was. And I do know we need to undergo paradigm shifts if the field is to keep moving forward. But I'll conclude my remarks by this thought that the best kind of rebellion is the kind that still sees irreplaceable value in the very thing you're rebelling against. God bless the philologists. I hope they're around forever because we need them. And eventually, you know, my attitude has always been, let a thousand flowers bloom. Buddhist studies just means we study Buddhism. We don't have to use the same disciplines. We don't have to do it the same way. We benefit by an interdisciplinary approach. We would never have known the importance of the Lotus Sutra had we not seen how it was being used in East Asian Buddhism, but we still needed the philologists to give us reliable translations of the Lotus Sutra. And so in the end, it all works together. We don't have to break into camps and fight against each other about what Buddhist studies ought to be doing. We will never march in lockstep, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. So I will preface reading what Steve submitted to me by first saying he did undergo open heart surgery yesterday, but his surgeon was very happy with how it went. He's still in ICU. But this he wrote at 10 p.m. before he went into surgery, you know, 6 a.m. the next morning. So, you know, his mind is fine. Okay, this is what he wrote. The devas and their realms have been as shadowy in Buddhist studies as their natural invisibility to humans might suggest. Attending to them illuminates many unseen dimensions of the tradition. It would be impossible to briefly unpack them all. I write from a hospital room, so please forgive me if this is not as elegant as it should be. I'll focus on issues for our hosting institution. In this same building, at a conference not long ago, I overheard elite scholars suggest that the Shin Buddhists' desire to meet their parents in the afterlife is inconsistent with the core teaching of no self. If they were more familiar with the devas in Pali Suttas and narratives, they would have known such hopes were normative even before there was a Mahayana, as with Anathapandika and his daughter, and so many others. One could then go on to ask whether even the suttas are inconsistent with no self, when instead we should ask why our understanding of no self is inconsistent with the tradition. This misperception of modern Japanese practice actually reflects a common misunderstanding among elite scholars about a basic doctrine and its implications for karma and rebirth. If no self denies karmic continuity, then the whole tradition missed the boat. It's not the Japanese grandmother who stands corrected in the light of elite scholarship, but the other way around. Conduct, even common conduct, is commentary. Practice is commentary. And its analysis can even inform our understanding of philosophical constructions. Another contemporary Pure Land scholar offensively writes that the tradition of other power is so antithetical to the original tradition of self-power that, quote, the Buddha would roll over in his grave. How disappointing this would be to Indian Buddhists who called out Namo Buddha during shipwrecks or relied on the power of relics to assure their rebirth in the heavens, or the Abhidhamma Kosha tradition, first taught in heaven, that speaks of attaining heavenly rebirth through a single mind to faith, mind of faith, to the marrow of one's bones that overcomes infinite bad karma. Here we see the classic Orientalist move of idealizing an historically dubious past form of Buddhism, distilled from texts curated by the scholar, and then denigrating the living tradition as degenerate. A related recent tendency is the fundamentalist attempt to seek out a red letter Dharma and bypass centuries of Buddhist practice and texts as non-canonical. The enduring power of the merit field of the teacher of devas and humans is an engine for diverse modes of heavenly attainment. These modes are not to be dismissed as low, popular, non-monastic, female, Hindu-influenced, or non-Indic Chinese invented practices. The collapse of these categories has broad implications from the interpretation of art historical evidence to processes of cultural transmission, etc. There is also a common misconception that heavenly rebirth, advocated in the initial graduated talk offered by Theravada monks to converts, and often attained by deathbed Buddha Anusmriti, with rituals strikingly resonant with Chinese Pure Land practice, is some kind of mistaken attainment. This suggests that Pure Land's practice orientations are a similar sort of aberration. But few Buddhists ever thought they would attain liberation in their lifetime. Even Buddhaghosa, in his Visuddhimagga, aspired to heavenly rebirth. And the tradition regards him as being there now, along with a host of great Buddhist ancestors, from Buddha's mom to Xuanzang. The devas are the blessed dead who sustain their presence in the heavens through their devotion to the Dharma, never to fall like those intoxicated with bliss. Also consider that a rarefied few ever understood or considered emptiness or no self, which are dubiously regarded as the secret sauce to Buddhist ethics and practice. From early Indian tradition to its East Asian distillations, the vast majority of Buddhists have aspired to rebirth in pure, blissful worlds of limitless light and longevity that were ideal for religious attainment. Pure Land priest Yoshiharu Tomatsu reports that in Japan today, advocates of the mindfulness movement denigrate Pure Land Buddhists as non-Buddhist, just as scholars suggest it is not Indic. There is even the stunning error that there is no Sanskrit antecedent for the expression Pure Land. But while Pure Land is richly continuous with the flow of living tradition, modernisms threaten the core practices and beliefs that sustained Buddhism for millennia by emphasizing elite philosophical conceptions and a radically contracted perception of authentic meditation practice and devaluing ideas of karma, rebirth, and devotion. The emphases on philosophy and meditation that eclipse and impoverish our perception of many dimensions of Buddhism are enduring residues of the scientific Buddhism so well documented by Donald Lopez. They call us to reflect on the powers of our own ways of knowing and their potential to transform their objects. We will never see the Dharma until we can see the Devas. Okay, that was the. So now we will move to discussion, and we just invite on screen Susan and Miranda to join us. There won't be a big shifting of chairs because it's just the two of us.
We stay.
And so we have. I have too many scheduled. 2:45. Wow, we have 35 minutes. So we can really open up the discussion and not have to keep cutting people off. But we will start with the panelists.
Are you waiting for one of us to jump in?
Yeah, someone, okay. If a panelist, that's Susan, Miranda, and Chuck. I won't count myself as Steve for this purpose.
Well, I mean, apropos of what Professor Jenkins was saying at the end of his paper, there was a very interesting article, I think it was by Joseph Walser, who went through and cataloged how many times the Buddha actually talked about the doctrine of no self and who he discussed it with. And he determined it wasn't really a major theme of his teaching. He didn't talk about it all that much, and he never spoke of it to anybody from a Brahmanical background, even among his own monks, which I found was very interesting. So it is later people who made it, you know, the be-all and end-all of Buddhist thought. For the Buddha, it was sort of a throwaway line.
Well, I think that one the question that you had posed in the written materials that we received was what might be missing from the book, and where would we go from here in terms of trying to change paradigms. And my question is not so much for people on this panel. I didn't find anything that was really missing from the book. I mean, I think it's an amazing compilation of studies and thoughts on a variety of different topics. But the question I have for all of us is really, how do we proceed moving forward? Because it's not as if there's a clean slate. We have existing paradigms that are very strong and controversial. And how do we start moving the field ahead?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is quit making pronouncements about what's really Buddhism.
Who do we have the conversation with, though? Is this something, for example, at AAR meetings and so on, that one wants to gain a bigger presence? Or where is it that one starts the conversation to really make change?
Well, I think what was just suggested is that we start by conversations with practitioners and quit writing them out of our scholarship as being somehow a degeneration of the practice. When I face a Buddhist practitioner in Taiwan, I'm not going to say, oh, I don't think you're really Buddhist. I mean, to be a scholar of Buddhism is to be a scholar of Buddhists, because there is no disembodied Buddhism apart from Buddhists. And my job is to find out what they have to tell me, and not go setting up categories that I try to put them in without even consulting them about it. I don't even know why they would care what I think, frankly.
But what do we do with historical periods? Because we cannot interview people who lived 2,000 years ago. So we can't rely on that firsthand evidence. So where do we go?
Well, there was an anthropologist who once wrote about how do you approach the kosher code in the Book of Leviticus when we don't have access to the people who lived 3,000-4,000 years ago who wrote these things down. And she said, well, the first problem we run into is that we take what the text says and then immediately try to make it answer our questions and not the questions that the text itself raises. So one of the, for example, the question that plagues people is, why is there this prohibition against eating pork in the Levitical code? And she pointed out two things. One is there's prohibitions on way more things than pork. You can't eat weasels, for instance. But we don't worry about why there'd be a prohibition against eating weasels, because none of us wants to eat weasels. But, you know, pork is so yummy, it's the other white meat. That's what grabs our attention, and so that's what forms the question. And then second, she said, if you read the text closely, you will often find that the text itself answers your question. Every proscription in the Levitical code is followed by a statement, I, the Lord your God, am holy, and therefore you must be holy. So there's your answer right there. You can do further textual study to try to figure out what holiness meant to them. So we can, in a sense, have a conversation with the people of the past if we not only read their text, but read them closely and try to bracket the questions that we want to put to them based on our own background and try to say, what is this text trying to say? And that involves, you know, Roger Ames and David Hall in their book Anticipating China said the encounter with other cultures frequently starts with just clearing away the deadwood of our own cultural knowledge that drives our questions. And you do this by focusing on the very things that you find incomprehensible and confusing, and use the principle of charity to assume it made sense to somebody at some time. And if you beat your head against it long enough and treat it like a koan, you may actually have a breakthrough. And that's what keeps me in this business, that opportunity that I may actually have a new thought from the encounter with people who wrote thousands of years ago on the other side of the world, to be able to think something that I never could have thought without them, you know, being there in front of me. I'm sorry, that's a really long way to answer.
I disagree with you on one basis, which is, how do we find the authoritative text that speaks for more than just the person who might have written it and that lineage? The text that we know in Buddhism, we don't have a single one from earlier than at least several hundred years after the Buddha. And we don't have them even in those versions. They all exist in later translations. And we all know the difficulties of translating, finding words that people today will understand. Those texts have been not only translated, but they have been copied and recopied and recopied and recopied. We don't have any text that I think we can say is, this is the it. So the question is, even if we could find everything, all the answers in texts, which texts? how are we, what are we don't have authoritative texts.
I have to ask you, what is the it?
Okay, so, well, I think what I was trying to say is, if what you were saying is true, that is, we can't have a conversation with people who lived 2,000 years ago. We can read the written words that existed. Now, first of all, I would argue that even if we had the original text, it wouldn't speak for all of the people, just like I would have to argue that a lot of the literature that's being written today really doesn't speak for me. So we have to define who that text was for. But the biggest problem that I find, and this is why, of course, I'm a great believer in archaeology and in the material record, those are documents of the actual period. We do not have texts from Buddhism that survive in their original form and language from the time they were written. So that is a structural problem that we have with texts. And it's a structural problem because we can't have confidence in what we are reading and what we are translating as authentic. Now, I'm not a text person, so some of the ones who've worked with text more might want to jump in. Now, as we get later, for example, into places where Buddhism was adopted later, such as Tibet or Japan and so on, it might be that those texts are authoritative. But when we're talking about India, we have nothing from those earliest periods.
But we have Ashoka inscriptions, you know, Ashoka inscriptions of 3rd century BC. Of course, they may not be the full text, but we are still some text, you know. So like the Pali Canon, for example, of course, you may not be able to find the palm leaves, but of course, the tradition says they were recorded in the first century Common Era, or just before the first century.
Of course, the inscriptions. I mean, of course, we have all the, but I consider those archaeological materials. And something like the Ashokan, the Ashokan inscriptions really aren't Buddhist texts in the sense of really propagating teachings. So the question is the original manuscripts. First of all, we probably had an oral tradition prior to anything being written down, such as from the early Buddhist council.
But inscriptions are manuscripts.
Yes, they are.
They are written records.
They're not complete. We don't have the sutras in inscriptions.
But there are ideas. Certain ideas are there. I think you can go back to, I mean, of course, not fully, but at least inscriptions give some indications, you know, what Ashoka believed and, you know, his principles. And he was much more down to earth because you know, they cannot be taken as fake.
No, I don't take them as fake at all. But I'm saying they're not complete Buddhist texts in the sense that when someone sits down and translates a Buddhist text and tries to therefore reconstruct what people were thinking.
See, the Buddhists did not exist. Even the Buddha himself was not a Buddhist. We identify him as a Buddhist or Buddha. Buddha didn't have a label. You know, Buddha himself did not probably call himself as a Buddhist. So this is our label we are imposing on these early people, yeah?
So it seems that, you know, whether the evidence is textual or archaeological, that what it behooves us when we are trying to glean understanding from them, that we get as much of the socio-historical, economic, cultural, linguistic context in which it occurred, and be cognizant of our own current lenses and be aware of the dance that's going on in trying to understand. We can't truncate our own backgrounds, but we can try and look at something, whether if it's, you know, original, or we'll never know. It's always what we can glean from putting together pieces of the puzzle. So we're always chasing something elusive. We all want to understand, but we can only get glimpses.
I think, you know, also there is still the question of even whatever might be the status of the text as an authoritative source, it's inextricably linked from the person reading it and asking questions in their effort to try to understand. I mean, understanding isn't like I'm ignorant and then suddenly the transmission of the text enlightens me and now I have the answer. It's much more complicated than that, I think. You know, making the transition to thinking about images. An image is not, in a sense, self-interpreting. There's still a question of someone's interaction with it, their point of view, the angle that they come at it toward, and the set of assumptions they bring to making sense of their experience of having a relationship with it. So I'm not trying to say that texts don't present their own particular challenges of interpretation, particularly when, you know, in all honesty, they, in the 19th century, they were read very selectively. It's not that there were no references to these devas. They were just ignored because they weren't consistent with the dominant paradigm of what Buddhism should be as an atheistic tradition. So I guess the larger framework I would bring to this is that opening up more channels of communication to me is the best way to begin to address this question of texts or objects and what they mean. It really is a question of, expanding the kind of sorts of conversations you have. And I think in a way, this issue of authority is, again, it is a form of practice. There's ways in which authority can be secured. Practice plays a role in that. You certainly want people who are translating text to have a solid understanding of the vocabulary and syntax. That's pretty important. They're not just making it up. It's valuable to have certain skills but that doesn't finally answer the question of what does the text mean. It doesn't deliver a single message. It's a message that emerges relationally through conversation and engagement with the text and then also with larger communities of practice who then discuss what they think the text is saying.
Bob, do you want to join the conversation?
I just want to make just two things, because this may have run its end, I'm not sure, but one grumpy comment and then one very specific comment for Susan. The grumpy comment is, I admit that I don't get it. People who work on ritual think that other people aren't paying enough attention to ritual. People work on art think that people aren't paying enough attention to art. Dance, it's the same. Even people who are doing philological work, I mean, somehow that's become the boogeyman, but they're in the minority now, and they think that nobody's reading texts carefully anymore. So I'm not, if everybody does what you do, it doesn't mean you're right. And if nobody does what you do, it doesn't mean you're wrong. And everybody ends up doing what they want to do. So I have to admit, I don't understand where, like, what the issue is. Now, here's a very specific question, which is unrelated to that, to Susan. One of the things you mentioned is that, and it's an interesting thing, that there doesn't seem to be any evidence that there was a real discussion about the status of images in the earliest period. I think that's the comment that you made. And I just wondered about your reading of the Udayana image story, which seems to be an attempt to legitimize the worship of images, or at least that's the way a lot of people take it. And that's always seemed to be a very natural way to understand that story. And it's hard to understand the need to legitimize the worship of images if there wasn't some controversy around it. So I just wondered about your comments on that vis-a-vis your talk. Thank you.
I do talk about the Udayana image in my essay, and of course the fact that it had become a prototype that was copied again and again and again, such as in the Seryoji image in Japan, and hundreds and hundreds of times it's been replicated. And the traditional interpretation that kind of has been used to support the aniconic theory is that the Udayana has been used to legitimize the image theory. I mean, if you read what I have written in a number of publications, I'm basically making the argument that that is not necessarily a later justification. it's essentially part of the understanding of images as having two kinds of mechanisms of coming into being. And one are the svayambhu, that is the self-originated, or the ones that were already empowered when they were created, because they were living beings. And then the second category are those that have to be invested with their powers through consecration and rituals and so on. So I know that that is the traditional reading of the Uddiyana, as if it's a justification. I don't see it at all. I think it's basically, just as with the Mahamuni image, the Jowa image, and many other images that we find throughout Buddhism, it's an explanation of how the image actually functioned as a surrogate for the Buddha. So I have a different reading for it. And let's just say that the Uddiyana, that is a justification for the aniconic theory. That's just one thing. We have so much other evidence that doesn't support that. And I think if we would be hanging that entire theory, which is so embedded in Western thinking about icons and the Buddha is a god, and he must, it's so Judeo-Christian. It's the Orthodox Jewish, it's the Islamic, it's hesitance within Christianity, that part of that dialogue, or do we use images and do we not? That conversation, I think, has been attached to the study of what is the Buddha image. And the only argument that ever was really the foundation of it was that they didn't find any early images. Well, if we didn't have a fossil record in stone for trilobites and who knows what else, we wouldn't know anything about them either. And so we are lacking a fossil record, but that doesn't mean that not only no images were produced, but they were deliberately not produced. So that deliberately part is, I think, something that has been projected onto Buddhism, which is, in my opinion, an iconophiliac religion as opposed to an iconophobiac religion. It's been superimposed on it as a rationalization for what is essentially an absence in the archaeological record. And we know that the earliest images, if you even read Chinese texts, they talk about the greatest merit being given to images that are made of sandalwood. Mm-hmm. Sandalwood is not going to survive for 2,500 years. And so what I see when we start to get the proliferation of the Buddha image in around the first and second centuries of the Common Era, it's the translation into stone. We now have it in so many places. If you read Lars Vogelin's wonderful work on archaeology, he talks about the fact that when we find the earliest, that doesn't mean it's the first. It's just become so prevalent that we can now find the earliest. So I think there were Buddha images way, way prior to the time they start to appear in stone. And the question is, how much earlier? And I feel, you know, based on how I feel the Buddha image is used, it was very early. So the Uddiyana, I mean, the question about the Uddiyana, it would just be one piece of evidence amidst a great deal of other information that we would have.
Thank you, Susan. We have something from online.
The question online is, does dance transcend the physicality of the body to allow the quieting of the mind for a deeper meditative state?
We can't hear you, Miranda.
No, what? Say it again. I thought she was directing it to Susan.
Does dance transcend the physicality of the body to allow the quieting of the mind for a deeper meditative state?
So there's no transcending the body in the tantric understanding of the body, which spans the fleshly and then, you know, the mental and emotional, you know, that we would call it the neurophysiology, right? That the body's or register, generate our experiences in the sensory. So to calm the body is to calm the mind. To slow the body is to slow the mind. There's no distinction there. So the Vajrayana project is not to transcend the body. And I think that question would come out of a different paradigm of Buddhism, right? Some, you know, body is problem paradigm.
Thank you. Another question from the floor.
I have a question from Miranda Shaw about choreography in Charyat Nritya. I know that there's lots of creative choreography now. There's lots of people coming up with routines of mudra combinations that are not necessarily traditional. But is there much space for creativity insofar as altering choreography when the, I won't say dancer, when the Vajracharya has become the Buddha in whatever role he happens to be dancing for? Is there any allowance for him to alter in any way the organization of mudras in the dance?
Okay, that's an interesting question because, you know, we call choreography the movements. So yes, there's a span of movements. There's a, but the thing is the songs, what determines the progress of the dance is the songs that are sung, which are really sadhanas that describe the qualities of the deities. So the dancer knows the qualities that are being, can I say dancer, you know, the qualities that are being expressed. And so no two bodies are alike, but it's not like, you know, ballet where you would be trying to really replicate that before you can bring your own spin on it. But do you mean literally change the choreography or do you mean just interpret it?
I mean, full disclosure, I've been trained in Charyat Nritya and all the dances that I learned follow the same organizational structure every time. I mean, my way of doing the mudra is going to be a little different than that person's. Ideally, it should be the same, but it's not going to happen. So I just wonder, is it possible to alter the exact order that the mudras come in, or must one always abide by that particular order? I've always wondered this, and I'm kind of away from asking that question.
Oh, I see. So it's hard for me to answer off the top of my head because if you know a variety of ways of doing a certain mudra, like for example, I'm thinking of Vajrayogini's Katwanga, that could be shown somewhat different ways. Or like, how do you hold a skull cup kind of thing? But yes, someone can, like Zhao, can choreograph a dance or can put in different movements for the same, especially the transitions, right? And the movement, but really the dance is about learning, like discovering these qualities within yourself. And as you do that, but you are trying to replicate the movements that are like, that are representative in the way that a statue, right? That, or like the Dana Mudra, that is a gesture or a pose that you're trying to replicate. And I don't know what else would go there, but I have to think about the way you're framing it. New dances can be created. Dances have some variation, but I don't want to go on too long without a clear answer.
I'll send you an email and talk about it.
That would be better.
Nancy, then Jisa Joy.
Thank you. I have a comment on this question that Susan is raising, a kind of broader question, I think, for this whole event of where do we go from here? Right, that I think Bob is also responding to, and I would agree with what you're saying that Bob, about that each of us tend to study what we're interested in, and also not only that, what we're trained to do, what we're competently trained to do, and hopefully we don't overstep, you know, what we are competently trained to do, or if we want to do that, we're going to try and do that, you know, gain those skills and training that we would need to branch out into other areas. But so, and then one way that, that we can share that is like to compile it in a volume that Kevin and Paula did, that we're celebrating and commemorating today. And I think that this event is noble in its own way as a further extension of what that volume is doing and to ask, what can we learn from each other? And that's the sense that I have in the format of this event of having authors, contributors comment on each other's work to have a conversation. But I wonder, and sort of maybe turn this around into a new question, like what each of you as contributors, you know, or as just a participant in this event, like what you might advocate for if you are interested in this question of where do we go from here? You know, is it, you know, option one, like, okay, we all learn something from each other, from the respective interests that we have, and we're going to go back and it's wonderful that we learned something. We're going to go back and do our own work, you know, and, you know, doing some other new form in the next publication. Or two, you know, next possibility is this, could this change how we approach our own sources and our own research? You know, is something that someone else is doing on some other topic going to change how we approach our own work? And three, maybe like the most radical, is would this lead us to rethink how we do research at all? You know, how we train our students? Are we going to continue doing single authored work, you know, and compiling those in edited volumes, or think about some other model of research and authorship? So I just want to put that out there as, you know, kind of things to think about for that bigger question of what's the next step.
If I could just jump in, I really like the way you expressed that. That's really wonderful. And it makes me think that for me, the shift in the paradigm doesn't necessarily mean, oh, now we only study dance or we only study images and so on. But rather, regardless of what we study, we recognize that it's only one lens, one portion of compiling the total picture. And I think that's part of the struggle, because I don't think, you know, transposing that is, or moving aside one traditional approach and then replacing it with another, I don't think that's the answer either. I think what this book and what this symposium really show is that there are multiple ways to both practice Buddhism and to look at Buddhism. And we need all of them to understand what the total picture is.
Thanks, Nancy, for that question. It was kind of along the lines of what I was thinking, but as I was listening to Mahinda talk about pilgrimage and this kind of pilgrimaging the mountain, paying respect to along the way, to just put it generally, and perhaps different rituals that happen along the way. And then when I was listening to Susan, I was kind of looking through the lens of pilgrimage, and I'm, I guess, just wondering if the way Susan was talking was also talking about the way she, just to use you as an example, the way you or she pilgrimages into her research. And I guess my question is kind of around, like, entertaining the idea of, I wonder how each of us or you pilgrimage into your research, or the rituals that you undertake when you're researching, or these rituals of traditional academia versus, like, I don't know if it's versus, and bringing your own Buddhist practice into your research. And I guess I just wonder what you all think about this idea of academic research or Buddhist research, Buddhist studies research as a pilgrimage.
I have some thoughts on that. A question that hasn't come up yet today, except very briefly, was the ethic-emic distinction. And I always find it interesting when you're getting into Buddhist studies to compare it with other religious traditions where it has become unthinkable that somebody who doesn't belong to that tradition could be teaching it. I think of Judaic studies and Islamic studies. Somehow Buddhist studies remains a tradition which anybody can jump into and study anybody else. But the question has been put to me, you know, how do you as a non-Chinese, non-Buddhist, study Chinese Buddhism? And the academic distinction comes in, but it has been a pilgrimage. One of the problems that I think we run into as academics is to start to think that understanding is a toggle switch that's on or off, that you either totally get it or you totally don't get it. I have found it to be an asymptotic progression. I get it a bit more the longer I work with it. And understanding that I will never have the insider's perspective doesn't faze me, because the very people I talk to when I do my studies, mainly Buddhists in Taiwan, don't care that I don't have their own internal understanding. They don't seem to particularly want me to. But just the fact that I am moving in their direction seems to give them some satisfaction, and that they will sometimes come to ask me, what do I think about a certain issue that is vital to their tradition? This led me to think of another way that's neither insider nor outsider. What if we had something called appropriate outsider's knowledge, which somebody once pointed out to me is A-okay. But what I mean by that is that you are an outsider, you are progressing in, you're never going to have insider's knowledge, and yet somehow what you do learn and teach is still good. And, you know, appropriate outsider's knowledge. And that's a category you might want to start playing with.
Well, being someone who's born betwixt and between, I've always seen it as a spectrum. And so to just be conscious of where the overlaps are and where they don't overlap, and that will also change over time as you learn more, as what you're studying, you know, more is revealed, or people change if you're studying people. And so it's just that awareness of what's getting put into what you're writing about or speaking about, and to that, you know, the myth of objectivity is not a friend. Because then we're looking for something static, and it's all fluid, and realizing the fluid nature of everything we're doing perhaps helps us keep opening up and flowing and including more and shifting, and no one's building a fort and a wall and saying, and being a guard at the gate saying, you know, that's not real research, that's not a canonical text, you can't use that as evidence. You don't get a grant, you don't get a job. I mean, they're real consequences. And also, you know, just the way people are treated in sanghas, that the fluidity that's, I think, part and parcel of rigorous scholarship is something that I think we could be more consciously aware of when we're especially constructors of knowledge.
See, I think you can study religion or Buddhism, being a religious person or non-religious person, because in the universities you are trained to think academically. And of course, if you have a religious background, if you know the languages, and if you know the history, there is an advantage for you to kind of grasp things a little bit thoroughly. But it doesn't mean that being a Christian and studying Buddhism, that person get it wrong. Or, you know, non-religious, when a Marxist studying Buddhism, I don't think he or she can get it wrong. Because when you publish, they are peer-reviewed, and you know, you present your work in conferences and so on. I think there are checks, you know, so I don't think whether being religious or not really matters being a scholar of Buddhism, because it's academic discipline. I think if you have a religious background, it helps, I think.
One last comment.
I would just like to emphasize what we're really looking for is patterns of culture. And culture is what gets transmitted. And it's not just random and always changing. There is something called parampara, that is tradition. And what we do have, and this is why the work of Tambaya and Spira and all these anthropologists who've spent time to get to know the languages so they can actually talk to people and then see the patterns in about enculturation and how Buddhism is passed down through the various media that are available, from art, from festival activities, from narrations of different stories, canonical, post-canonical, etc. That's a valuable part of this story. There are patterns to Buddhist tradition being passed down. And, you know, like I have worn out my Chinese pilgrims accounts, because there are some accounts and moments when the pilgrims ask, what are they doing here? Or why is this here? And then you get an account of how they've always worshipped at this well, and people believe that the Nagas come out every year on the full moon of such and such. So, and the reason I say that in part, and this is back to my own background, I can show you Newar rituals in the Kathmandu Valley that are very similar to what the Chinese pilgrims are describing 1500 years ago. Chariot festivals, for example, small, medium, and large. This is a very essential part of Buddhist tradition in many, many communities. And you see the tradition is still going on in Kathmandu. So it's not to privilege my group, but they're the last surviving group. They're like the very end of the parampara of Indic Buddhism. So I think there are patterns of culture and patterns of monastic intervention in human lives. There's the reality of death. There's the reality of suffering and the texts that again and again proclaim ways to alleviate human misery. So there are patterns. And I think to look for them is to really move the study of Buddhism ahead.
Thank you so much for that strong clarifying comment of looking for patterns in this very diverse world that we're in. Now I'll tend to our bodies again. We have a break. We'll reconvene at 3 o'clock, and we get to be treated by Dr. Anne Klein. Blackburn will be giving us the keynote address at 3 o'clock. So have some refreshments. See you back.
Thank you.